Hey everybody, Michael Thiessen here for Liberty Coalition Canada. And today I get to interview Dr. Patrick Phillips. And many of you will have heard about Dr. Phillips recently. I can look at two articles alone right in front of me from our major news sources that are trying to report on his story. But as you know, and as I certainly know, our mainstream media is only covering often one side of the story. So today we want to give Dr. Patrick an opportunity to just share with us exactly what's going on. So Dr. Phillips, thank you for being on with us right now.
Oh, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
So Patrick, the last time you and I spoke, it was 8 or 9 months ago now, and we were on a Zoom call just regarding a number of doctors who were going to speak out. And you just reminded me that the title of that video was Canadian Doctors Speak Out. And you were one of the doctors highlighted on that video. Basically, from that time on, you've kind of gone your own way with the doctors doing all of that wonderful work that you guys are doing. And Liberty Coalition Canada has been talking back and forth with you, but not maybe doing any direct projects together. So why don't you bring our listeners up to speed? And if it's okay, will you go all the way back to the release of that video and then kind of as contemporary as this last week?
Yeah. So there's been a lot happening for sure. I think most Canadians would notice that with the ramping up of the tyranny and restrictions. But going back, like you said, to last winter, that was when we released our first Canadian Doctors Speak Out video, which is basically a group of us doctors getting together and essentially to break the fear narrative. So at that time, it was becoming abundantly clear to us doctors who were looking at the research around COVID-19 and comparing it to the propaganda that was put out by the government and by public health officials. And the difference was just so staggering that we needed to let people know that there wasn't actually anything to be afraid of when it came to this virus, especially when you consider that even if there is something to be afraid of, there was treatment available. So we came together and put out this video. There were multiple segments to it. I think my section was addressing asymptomatic spread and how it's not a very significant driver of infection, even though that was the big fear component that got everybody afraid that they might get people sick, even though they feel they're perfectly healthy. But we also address treatment and other elements of the public health measures that were not actually helpful. And so that, I think, got hundreds of thousands of views. It took off pretty wildly. And that also began our saga with the CPSO or the medical colleges. So that was, I believe one of my first complaints was around that video. Not from any patients or anything, but just a member of the public saying that we're spreading misinformation. And that began either that or another one that happened very, very near the same time where doctors complained for the same thing, just that we're spreading misinformation. The CPSO began to investigate our medical, for some people it was our medical practices, but other times it was just monitoring our social media feeds. And so they assigned a bunch of investigators and started watching closely everything that we said.
Can I just jump in here for our listeners' sake? So the CPSO is the College of Surgeons and Physicians of Ontario. Yeah. And also just, I just want to note, you've used some language and I want everyone just to kind of hear it. So, Patrick, you just used the word, you know, propaganda, and then you use the word misinformation. And one is how you're describing what is going out from the government and the mainstream media. And I would say that when I watched your video, that you guys put out. I was so happy that Liberty Coalition Canada was a part of helping release that video. But when I watched it, it really did have its effect. Like, okay, mm-hmm. I understand this in context. And in fact, one of my project managers very early on where we became friends was he just did a whole lot of data mining on COVID in context, not just out there. So the video was fantastic and it mm-hmm. seemed very benign. It seemed quite okay. This is a number of doctors with a second opinion who have researched and done some good thinking. Fantastic.
Yeah.
I actually really expected much of the narrative to change, but today and to date, many people still are living as if COVID-19 is one of the most serious cancers ever to plague a people. Like if you get COVID-19, you get leukemia or, you know,
yeah.
So, that's where, you know, the where I can understand you really feeling like there's been a propaganda campaign because mm-hmm. there's been no open civil discourse. So I want to validate your use of that word. On the other yeah. hand, I do want to attack though, when we are talking about the other side that keeps talking about misinformation, mm-hmm. because that's their propaganda attack to say you can't question anything we say. And yeah. That's been also very disturbing because I know doctors like yourself have said, well, if it's misinformation, just show it to me scientifically. Like I know as a Christian man, as a pastor, as someone who is invested in ethics, I know I've been saying, well, if there's a biblical case here, show it to me, to my Christian friends. But it seems like, no, that's just misinformation. And so I think I just wanted to highlight that for our listeners, folks. We really are in a place where we're in a battle of really heightened dividing language. Mm-hmm. So please continue on, but I wanted to make sure people heard that because it's, oh, and also just one other thing, the regulatory bodies, they are there supposed to be there to protect your patients from you.
Like yes.
a very serious case of neglect or something mm-hmm. one-on-one that is very, what we would say, rooted in medical professionalism or medical protocol, yeah. not, hey, I called in the other day and I don't like his social media feed. Can you give a context for how different the college is acting now the way they would act historically?
Yeah. So medical colleges are there to basically protect patients and the public from dangerous doctors. So you could think of somebody who didn't have proper medical training or a doctor who became demented at age of 70 and you kind of have to, they're no longer competent to treat. And so we need to kind of get rid of their license because they're putting their patients at risk. The other thing too is like acts of professional misconduct. So if a doctor is sexually abusing their patient, that's something that patients need to be protected by because of that power dynamic. Or if a doctor is kind of using their doctor-patient relationship to take financial advantage of their patient, yeah. right? To kind of lure them into buying things they don't really need or things like that. So those are kind of the main roles of these medical bodies, and we're seeing now that they're overreaching in dramatic ways. They're reaching into medical practice to say you can do this or you can't do that, even if the medical evidence backs it up, because there's a large gray area within medicine, and medical practice changes all the time. If you think of aspirin, we used to recommend everybody take an aspirin to prevent a heart attack or a stroke. But about like 5 to 10 years ago, we actually found that, oh no, that actually increases your risk of death because you can get bleeds in your brain or bleeds in your stomach. from taking the aspirin. And it's only people who've had a heart attack or stroke should actually take it. But that's just an example that I give you of something that was considered widespread medical practice that is now known not to be recommended. And so that was never really the role of colleges to get involved in the minutiae of medical practice, because we need a bit of flexibility to have dissenting opinions and to allow first the science to progress. And now what we're seeing is the college coming in and dictating on very political matters, on saying what the science is and what the science isn't, even though it's just a group of bureaucrats, not an actual scientific leaders, right, in the who are heading up the research, who are running these colleges. So yeah, we're seeing a very different tone. And actually, what we see is some huge missteps where they're actually going against their mission in the first place. So if you think, for example, they're there to protect doctors from forcing you into medical treatments, right? So that's one of the main things. One of the main ethics that we have to hold up as professionals is to respect our patients' autonomy, that we offer you choices, but no doctor should ever force you into something. And if they did, you should report that to the college. And now we're seeing the opposite, where the college, the government actually is, government or employers are forcing patients into like gene therapy. If you think of these mRNA gene therapy injections, they're forcing them into it. And the college comes out and says, no, you can't write exemptions. You can't protect your patients from that coercion. So it's actually a flipping upside down of the college, who's there preventing doctors from protecting their patients from coercion. So it's very disturbing. It's a kind of the opposite of what they were created to do. And we're also seeing an inversion of the word professionalism. So these professional bodies are there to uphold professionalism in medical practice. And what professionalism used to be was, like I said, that professional oath, like that we take a Hippocratic oath, or if you think of the Declaration of Geneva, where we vow to put our patients' interests first. No matter what any government authority says, we're not going to take away your autonomy. We're going to put your interests first, not the interests of some other government body. So that was what professionalism was, right? It was that kind of dedication to the patient and the fiduciary duty to them. And now these government bodies, like the colleges, are saying that professionalism is following every rule that we tell you to, no matter how it affects your patient. So it's kind of, again, it's an inversion of the professionalism that these bodies were created to protect.
I actually really like that example, or let me try to give an example of that. You know, when you mm-hmm. thought of that, when you said that, I thought immediately of like the professionalism of an engineer that builds a bridge. And mm-hmm. even if a government bureaucrat comes along and says, you know what, we really want to build that bridge cheaper. And by the way, my nephew over here is the contractor who we want to build the bridge. You need to do what he says. Mm-hmm. It would typically be the association or the regulatory body of professionals that the engineer is voluntarily a part of that would support the engineer to say, no, here are the standards of the way that we do things, and you're going to build the bridge properly, or you'll have my association to deal with. That's where it's supposed to come from. It's not supposed to be the engineer showing up on the property and then the association say, no, build that bridge cheaper. And the rudimentary smart businessman, construction guys know their stuff. You know, the guy who's been building bridges for 30 years goes, look, dude, I don't care if you're an engineer or not, that bridge is going to fall apart. I've built enough of them with you, for you. It makes absolutely no sense. I'm not building that bridge. And now you have the association pushing the engineer, and then mm-hmm. the engineer pushing the guy who knows how to build the bridge to just build a stupid bridge.
Yeah.
To nowhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a corruption. Yeah. Cause professionalism is, like I said, that upholding your duty to the patient or just safety. If you think of the engineer, right. Of building that bridge safely, and the principles of scientific truth, you're going to base it on what your actual judgment as an engineer or as a physician is, not based on what you're told to do. If I, as a patient, for example, came in to see my doctor and asked them, doctor, what do you think I should do? Should I get this vaccine? It's a very dangerous concept that our professional bodies are telling us not to tell you what we actually think, and only to tell you, like, we're only allowed to say the government line. That creates a huge amount of distrust in the whole system. If we create the precedent that physicians have a script they have to follow, so you don't know when they're actually speaking freely and when they're just saying what they're supposed to say, so they don't lose their license. So that we're seeing these medical bodies like the CPSO actually kind of, by putting out those policies of telling us what we can and cannot say, of seriously undermining the trust in the medical profession in general.
So just to be clear, if you were an oncologist and you were on the 8th floor of Toronto Sick Kids, and I was a parent and you were a part of my oncology team, and there were, let's say, you know, one lead physician, and then there was a group on that, I wouldn't call the regulatory body if that group of doctors were having a disagreement on how to treat my son, per se.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, that would just be part of medical practice. Yeah, you get a second opinion, right? That, and because doctors are allowed to speak freely, right?
And now, isn't that why they typically care as a group? Because you go exactly. And you say, this is what I... But at no point, you know, are they also, the flip side of that, they're not walking around on eggshells that if someone doesn't want my care, they can leave.
Yeah.
But if I'm doing my medical inquiry, my diagnosis, my prognosis, all of those types of things, and they don't like it, their choice is to leave. But unless I'm doing something unethical, it's not like they're jumping on the phone saying, I've got a wart and I've asked my doctor 4 times to remove my wart and he just doesn't think I need to remove it. Would you please remove his license?
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's what we're seeing here with COVID measures, right? Where if you say anything that's outside of the party line, you're getting investigated and sanctioned, which, like you said, like, it creates not only a distrust on the level of the patient, right? Because they can't know what their doctor actually thinks. But on the level of the physician, you can't even think freely, right? Because if you say or think anything outside of the party line, you could lose your career.
So I really want to go to your personal story, but I want to just land on this for one more second, because this is what we would call a snitch culture. This is what we would call a culture where the only moral is, say, the party line. And it's a really sad place. And I as a pastor can't do it, because there's just too many people on this earth that disagree with my perspective, according to my faith, that I can't just, nope, this is the party line, say it. Well, unless I can derive the party line from scripture, the party line is getting chucked off into the garbage and burned out at the burn pile. Like, who gives a rip about the party line? And it's so dangerous. So I just want to equate this story to just one other thing. Like, I was on the phone with a business owner who said, look, like, I need to keep my business open. I want to keep my business open in the name of freedom, meaning it's my conviction to let people dine without masks. And it's my conviction to let people to not check people's second Canadian passport at the door. But I've got customers who will come in, happily consume my food, and then snitch on me. And it's like, you don't know what to do. So you don't know how to be moral, and you don't know how to be encouraging, other than you'll be penalized if you don't repeat the narrative. So, okay, I really want to hear more about your story, but that's just some really good concepts that I think our listeners need to hear about that we're going through. So thank you for bringing that to the forefront of our discussion.
Yeah. And I think that's an important point. But I think, I mean, even bringing it back to my own story, because I thought about that, right? At some point, I my life on some level could be a lot easier if I toe the party line, right? I'd probably be able to, maybe not at this point, but at some point in the past where I definitely thought about this, I could just become quiet and say what the government wants me to say, do what the government wants me to do, no matter what I think that the effect that will have on society or my patients. And my life on some level would be easier. I wouldn't be penalized. My license wouldn't be threatened. But you have to take that another step forward, and you have to look at what would that do to you, right? What kind of respect would I have for myself? What kind of respect would others have for me? If I knowingly went along with this plan that I saw was harming patients, when I had patients coming to me asking my medical advice, and I lied to them and told them what the government or the Ontario Medical Association told me to tell them. If I had a patient who came in to me for COVID and I said, oh no, sorry, there's no treatments available, when I knew that there are treatments available in the pharmacy down the street, right, that I know has a 50 to 70% chance of reducing their chance of death, reducing their chance of death by 50 to 70%. Like, I couldn't do that, right? You have to, like, that would destroy your soul. And it requires you, these kind of tyrannical snitch cultures, if you buy into them, you kind of end up selling your soul. You lose a big part of who you are, of your self-respect, of your integrity. And when you do that, it makes you feel kind of awful. And the only way that I think some people are able to deal with that is by snitching on others. Well, I did it, so you need to fall in line too, right? And so that's what kind of propagates this snitch culture, is people who are miserable, have lost their integrity, and just feel like getting everybody else in line and punishing them because they're just sucking it up and allowing themselves to be punished too. So yes, in some sense, it requires some sacrifice to live with integrity, but it's worth it, right? You maintain your integrity, and there's something that lasts so much longer than this petty life, right? When you are willing to uphold the truth, right? You're willing to put the interests of others first. I don't just do that for the benefit of others. It's not like a self-sacrificing thing. It's actually a very fulfilling thing to do. And I think that that's the choice that I've made, at least when it comes to this. I'm not a perfect person at all. But I found in this one area, you know, like, both. Yeah, I have a lot of faults. I'm not like always a loving, amazing saint, you know what I mean? Or anything like that, right? But what I found in this one area where we're being driven into this false narrative is that I'm not willing to just bow down and submit to the lie. And so I found on that level, like, it's very uplifting, and it creates a lot of positive momentum in your life. You end up meeting new people who are on that same level and who share the same values that you share, and your life can be kind of passed along a difficult but an overwhelmingly positive course that somehow always seems to work out. And so that's kind of been my experience. I mean, it's true, I can kind of get into the details of all the College of Physicians and Surgeons coming after me and administrators.
I do want to get into some of those details so people understand the weight of what you're carrying. Before we go on there, I think a very important part of this is, it goes along with the comment that you were making about how if I just go along, if I just shut up to put up, mm-hmm. that eventually affects me. And so some people, it might affect them with deep depression. Some people, it might affect them to want to tattletale on other people. Other people, it might just make them angry. Other people might cope with it with drinking. We've seen a number of increases of suicides and things like that, that people would cope on. There's something even more dangerous than that. And that is, if I tell a lie long enough and loud enough, I start believing it. So then one of the things that I've been concerned about from day one is, if lockdowns work and if all freedom is arbitrary other than a few people, then the doctors who actually believe that will keep doing this. They'll keep pushing this methodology because they actually have gotten into the habit that sick, that healthy people are sick until proven innocent.
Yeah.
Like that whole comment that you were talking about, asymptomatic, way back at the beginning. I walk around where people look at me and they go, "You are a death virus petri dish waiting to kill me." And you go, "No, I'm not. I'm healthy. Like, I got allergies. I got bad hair. I'm short. What?" Like,
yeah,
you know what I mean? And so one of the things that is really scary is that people go beyond their coping measures to actually just believe, "I cannot think for myself. I cannot tell the truth. There is no truth. I can't know anything. I'm totally confused. I'm just going to do whatever the government tells me to all the time." Yeah. And they develop habits that lead them to just being so gullible, but leading such a life that is full of absolutely irrational fear. So, okay, before we go on and talk about the college, people are still dealing with that fear, Patrick.
Yeah. So
can you contextualize COVID just really quick for us, as compare it to another virus, or I don't know, but can you try to contextualize that really briefly? And then I want to get into the amount of heat that you're taking for these views.
Yeah. So, yeah. So COVID in itself, there have been a number of reviews, and in its, as far as the mortality from COVID itself goes, it's actually closer to a bad flu year. It's actually not super significant. So what they found is if you are age 70 and above, it is more deadly than the flu. If you're age about 30 to 70 or 65 or so, it's about the same mortality as the flu. And if you're under 30, it's less dangerous than the flu for most people. We know the risk factors for it. So if you have low vitamin D, so if you have, which risk factors of that are like if you're obesity, old age, and dark skin color, then your risks are higher. But that is a lot of those risks are fixable by taking vitamin D as well. Obesity is a risk factor, and insulin resistance. But again, that's something that's able to be fixed with diet, like a ketogenic diet, intermittent fasting, or fasting can reverse that insulin resistance really quickly. You don't have to lose 600 pounds. You can do it all pretty quick. So, and outside of that, we have a ton of treatments that are highly effective for COVID-19 that are very safe, such as ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine. There's multiple others, nitazoxanide and others. They're all repurposed drugs that have been around for years and have been proven to be safe. And so even if you're in those high-risk categories, there's treatment available. And so there's no reason to be afraid of COVID, right? Even if you catch it, like I said, there's treatments available, and we're working to get those available to people throughout the country, although they're trying to shut a lot of those treatments down. But considering the scientific knowledge we have around this, this is a treatable disease. It's around the same mortality as the flu, and we do not need to be afraid. What we need to be afraid of is the way our government's responding to this virus, and the way they're eroding fundamental basic rights, that is extremely dangerous and is something to be afraid of. Although the fear is not the solution to that. The solution is actually for people to own their own power, right? And to stop being afraid of the government.
So why don't we go there? So how are they treating you? What's going on? Share what you can, and maybe what triggered your most recent persecution? What triggered your most recent attack on your professional opinion?
Yeah, so I mean, I can't get into the details of all my accusations, I guess, at this point, but in general, the main thing they're coming after me for is, like you said, spreading misinformation. But I think you can see from some of the other restrictions they put on me most recently, they've restricted me from giving any kind of exemptions to COVID-19 vaccines, treatments, or masks. Oh, sorry, testing or masks. And I've been very vocal on social media around this exemption issue, especially because free and informed consent is enshrined in Canadian law. It's a principle actually in assault criminal law, and that there's good precedent on that, that if you're forced by somebody into a medical treatment, even if it's not the doctor who's forcing you, but if, say, your employer is saying that you have to get your tubes tied or you're going to lose your job. If you told that to the physician and said, I really want to get my tubes tied so I don't lose my job, that physician committed assault on you if you were coerced into that medical treatment. And that there's precedent of that in law that has been proven in court. And so it's enshrined in the college regulations. In Ontario, we have the Healthcare Consent Act that states that all consent must be voluntary, and if it's coerced, it's not valid consent. But also in the Criminal Code of Canada, any kind of force on your body, even if you comply with it, is assault, unless like they basically give the criteria. But basically, assault is any force acted on your body that is if it's done under force of authority. So if your boss says you have to get this COVID test or you're going to lose your job, and you comply and get that COVID test, that's assault because you did it under force of authority. So that is in the Criminal Code of Canada as well. But that's just an example. So there's on multiple levels it's enshrined in Canadian law. So these kind of vaccine mandates, physicians are forbidden from actually participating in vaccinating somebody who's under coercion. And at this point in our society, with vaccine mandates in place and widespread coercion, pretty much everybody's being coerced. And so nobody should be getting these vaccines. And if you are, you're likely being assaulted, or you're being coerced, which is against the law. And so I said that physicians should be offering exemptions based on this coercion, because when we write notes for patients, we're supposed to put down our medical judgment. And if my medical judgment is that you're being coerced, then you're ineligible to receive a vaccine. And that's just based on the law, that's based on medical ethics, and that's based on clinical judgment. And that's what physicians have the duty to do. Because like you said, when speaking about professionalism, our duty is to patients and to their interests, and to respect their autonomy over their own bodies. That's the duty of every physician. It is not to force you or participate in forcing you into those. And medical exemptions are one way for physicians to protect their patients and to uphold their oath to put patients first. And so the college didn't like that. So of course they banned me from writing medical exemptions. But they haven't changed their policy. So they're very unclear. They act in very opaque ways. So they don't always let you know what their intentions are, what their policies are. They often offer vague guidance and come after doctors who just kind of don't follow their narrative, or they continue to speak freely about scientific truth or about medical ethics that they they don't like. So that's part of what's going on. They've also banned me from offering COVID-19 treatments. So I'm banned from providing ivermectin to patients or fluvoxamine or atorvastatin or things like that that have been shown to be helpful. So anyway, all of these are allegations, I guess, that I'm, I guess, acting unprofessionally in doing these things. And so there have not been proven in the tribunal. And so that's kind of our next step, to go to the tribunal and to try to win my case. But in this case, the CPSO is kind of the judge, jury, and executioner when it comes to these kinds of matters. So it might need to be appealed to a higher court in a later time.
Well, I certainly hope that you have success, and that it, if you don't have success, that it will be appealed to a higher court. I'm just reading the CBC article put out by, I'm trying to look for the author here. Ironically, it doesn't even have an author listed to this article, strangely enough.
Yeah, so one thing I can tell you, the CBC, CTV, Global News, City News, the CPSO actually at 11:59 p.m. on that Monday, released this without my knowledge. So I had no idea that any of these restrictions were coming, that any of these allegations were even made. They released it at 11:59 p.m. They had, and all the news stations all across the country had this story and published it that morning before I knew anything about these accusations against me. And so it's very clear, like the CPSO works very closely with the media, and it became very apparent to me how much of a machine, a propaganda machine really, that we have in this country, that they could kind of make a hit piece all across the country before I even heard anything from the CPSO. So,
you know, just on that note, like, I'm dabbling into trying to do investigative reporting with this little podcast. And that's literally what people are waiting for. Like, if someone were to call me up and say, I've got this really great, in fact, this is why we're talking, you know, it happened to you, and somebody reached out to you and said, hey, do you want to talk to Michael? And I said, sure. And so these reporters are just jumping for, give me the story and I'll get it out. Like, that's it. Mm-hmm. People don't quite understand that it's not so innocent. And I admit that even for my own side of things, there's this like, ooh, I dropped that story and oh, we got it out and it got the most amount of views. And so there's a lot of pressure to release quickly and think later. Mm-hmm. I just want to draw some attention to the horrible language that they're using about you. You know, they say that you're incompetent, disgraceful, and dishonorable. Those are all quotes from the College of Physicians and Surgeons. These things are like, I equate this to the insults of a teenager who doesn't want to, you know, play rugby against me, or doesn't want to play chess against me. Like, you know, you're sitting there in the middle of a chess game and somebody walks by and says, you incompetent loser. wait a minute. And then I was reading further on, because they've even made comments about Dr. Kulvinder Kaur Gill. And I don't know if I'm pronouncing her last name exactly, but look, I followed her on Twitter. There is not a single tweet that I have read from that woman that it says here, it lacks professionalism and failure to exercise caution. And she's making such simple statements.
Yeah.
It's just statements that are in disagreement with this college. And so, you know, they've called Dr. Julie Panessi, I've had people call Dr. Julie Panessi a blight on our Canadian society. I had a retired pastor say that about this. So we're in a land of insults over investigation time and time again. And I'm sorry that you're going through that. I legitimately want to say, Patrick, I'm sorry that you're going through that, because when I am called incompetent, as a pastor or as a teacher, that those are deep daggers, and it, mm-hmm. it really causes you to question. On the other side of that, the video that we published with you guys, the organizations that I know you continue to be a part of, people like Dr. Kovinder, as a thinking man, I cannot come to the conclusion that the word to describe all of you is incompetent.
Mm-hmm.
Like you have to be a pretty biased, foolish listener. I could disagree with you. I'm sure if you and I were to talk about worldview issues, you know, you're being interviewed by a Christian pastor. I'm sure there's some stuff that you might want to go, hey, later on over coffee, you and I, let's go over these worldview issues. Like even medically, there might be questions that I have, but the reality of it is that incompetent seems so far away from what I am experiencing as I talk to those of you who are simply asking for civil discourse and a slowdown and to be careful about how far the government is coursing us. So I don't know, how are you responding to all of these name calling? It's basically what it is. It's high school name calling.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, their language is almost archaic in a sense. It's hard. It's hard, especially when you're like the focus of a nationwide media smear campaign, right? And you have all your relatives and family calling you up, asking if you're okay. Like, it is hard. But at the same time, it's something that I've chosen consciously. And I think that's what's a big comfort in this, is that I knew I was putting myself in the line of fire when I chose to speak out, because I knew that the college does these kinds of things. They're actually kind of well known for it. They can be pretty brutal with physicians. And like I said, they don't have much oversight, so they can get away with a lot of overreach. And if they want to take you down, there's not much that can stop them. And so, so it's interesting here that they actually put a press release out about me. It's rare that they do that. So that must mean that what I'm saying and what I'm doing must be having an effect. So I think in that sense, it's a bit of an affirmation, in the sense that what I'm doing and my message is having an impact on people. And so for that, I'm grateful. I'm grateful that I'm one of the ones at the top who they feel they need to take down. But at the same time, I've consciously chosen to step out in front of them to undermine their agenda of undermining patient consent, of freedom of patients to decide what they put in their own body, of physicians' duty to put their patients above obedience to government agency. I've come out there and I've undermined, and I will continue to undermine that policy that is a gross violation of ethics. And so, yeah, they're going to come out and they're going to attack me and they're going to name call me, but they're the ones in the wrong here, and I don't feel like I've done anything wrong. So
does it help you to see how corrupt everything is? Like I want to say, like, I would have to say the Toronto Star was very gentle with me. That's partly because I just don't do any interviews without doing them via email, because I mm-hmm. don't want to misspeak. But like they put a bit of a, you know, far right wing nationalist, you know, they painted us with that type of brush for the Liberty Coalition Canada. And I just you know, forwarded the article and said, the Toronto Star just called me a rock star. It literally just called me a rock star. It said that when I show up to rallies, they treat me like a rock star. It's been in print. I am a rock star, because it's just so silly. And I want to stay on this point. I want our listeners to hear this. And I'm fully admitting my own sinful nature in this. When people are trying to get information out, there is just the success of getting the information out, whether you do your due diligence or not. And did any of those news stations, any of those media publications give you an opportunity for statement prior to that press release?
I don't think I saw anything prior to that press release. Some of them, I don't have a lot of like public access to Neil Nye. I got so many messages on Twitter that I wasn't able to keep up with all of them. So I actually closed off my kind of public access that way. I did find a few days later, I think somebody from CBC asked for a comment or something, but
right.
Yeah. I don't think that would have made any difference. Like I don't. I don't really have much interest. I like they're the propaganda machine that's kind of destroying our country right now. I don't feel like I could say anything that they wouldn't just try to turn against me.
So I remember when I was like eight, I was either 8 to 12 years old. And I remember our church had done something really cool. And my buddy's dad was the pastor. And I remember him getting interviewed. And I was there right after the interview. And it was like nothing controversial. Like we could talk about some major worldview controversial stuff. This was like church built a playground and the color was yellow. Like nothing. And I remember him saying, yeah, I wonder how that's going to go. And even as like a young 12-year-old, go, well, why he's a reporter. Why wouldn't he just report what you just said? I heard what you just said. It's a nice little story. And sure enough, like picked up the Guelph Mercury a few days later. And there it was, our pastor looking like a buffoon over nothing. And it was just like that reporter chose to tell the story for their advantage and nothing else. Mm-hmm. You couldn't ever call it actual investigative journalism.
Yeah.
And, now, again, I think most of them would say, well, hey, that's what we did. They gave us a press release. Those are the names that they called him. And we just reported that that's what they called him. But man, no measure. No, you know, this is one side of the story, folks. Give us a week and we'll have the other side of the story from Dr. Patrick Phillips. Like no integrity at all. Just get it out. Get readership. Flashy headline. But you are feeling like it's a little bit easier the more ridiculous you realize that situation is, or no?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think so. Yeah, definitely. Because the more I see that's happening to society, the more I see people losing their jobs or people who are crying, like being forced into medical procedures they did not even want. The more I see our economy crashing, our healthcare system crashing, you see emergency rooms starting to close due to these mass firings. I'm seeing that society is kind of crumbling. And I what I know is that if I go down, I'm going to go down knowing I was on the right side of history and that I was at least one that chose to speak up and to speak for the truth and for basic medical ethics in the medical profession that are being lost. And so if I go down with that on my soul, then I think it's worth it.
So let me ask you about that. That's a story that's really interesting. Mass firings of nurses, and I would assume physicians, because medical professionals are concerned about getting the vaccine. So mass firings of nurses and physicians, and the administration of the hospital is just going wholesale. We are one of the most vaccinated nations on earth. Do you know of the numbers? Like, do you know of anything like, hey, there's 10 hospitals and there's 140 people leave in this hospital and that, because I don't think, again, it seems to be media silence on this type of thing. Like, I think our community would really want to know if 140 nurses were walking off the job, but I don't watch CBC anymore because I can't stomach it, but
I know.
Are you aware? Are people contacting you and saying, hey, this is what it is at this hospital, and this is what it is at this hospital?
I don't have the specifics for each hospital. I think there's the United Healthcare Workers of Ontario who are coming together. So basically hospital workers. And the last number that I heard of was about 2,500 that have at least joined together. So I'm guessing there's more that haven't even connected with that group, right? To look at legal action against the hospitals that are firing nurses and physicians. So it's at least that amount. I think there's thousands more in Quebec that they were about to fire on October 15th. But I guess it was, I forget if it was today or was yesterday, they decided to postpone that by a month, basically days before they were all going to be fired. And in that level, it's even more coercive because they're not just losing their jobs. They were going to suspend all their licenses. So you can't even work through telemedicine. You can't work in a private office or anything. They're taking away your ability to practice whatsoever. Whereas in Ontario, it's more at the hospital level, where they put in a policy stating that you have to either get tested 1 to 3 times weekly against your will, or get fired, or some hospitals actually implemented a vaccine requirement that if you don't get vaccinated, you lose your job, you lose your privileges, and ability to work in the hospital. So yeah, there's thousands affected for sure. It will cripple the system. And what I can tell you is already, even if that, like, it's already happening. I know lots of people who've been fired, but, even before that was the case, our system was close to being crippled. The way things have been with all these extra public health measures, there's a lot of extra workload in the hospital, and a lot of nurses were close to being at the point where they want to quit. And so what can happen there is when one nurse quits and they're not able to replace her, all the other nurses have to work harder. Right. And so when you're at that point, nurses start to get burnt out. And then what you notice is another one quits and they have to work even harder and then even more get burnt out and then even more quit. And that's often what happens when you reach that critical threshold of losing just enough nurses that everybody else is overworked. You can end up in a disaster, right, where you're not able to restaff the hospital.
Is COVID crashing the system, or is it what you and I are talking about? Like, or do we need to have a more balanced presentation here?
Yeah. So I think, is COVID crashing the system? I don't think so. I think our numbers right now are not very high at all in Ontario. So you can definitely not say that COVID is crashing the system. And even if you look at last year, the hospital capacity was under what the average was for like 4 to 5 years before that. So COVID is not crashing the system. And it can also be deceiving as well, because if you look at the ICU capacity, in a lot of places, it was running at like around 95%, which seems kind of scary, right? But when you look at the years before, a lot of ICUs were running at 110 to 115% capacity. And people are like, you don't realize that's actually the case. And what that means is that the ICU is running beds in the hallways, or they're running beds in the emergency department. So that's what it means to run over capacity. And that's actually been the norm in most hospitals in Ontario. So the whole idea that running at 95% capacity due to some COVID cases that we've had years to prepare for, is kind of ridiculous. it's not what's crashing the system. And the other thing you have to consider too is that we've been understaffed for beds for years. So that's a big part of what's crashing the system. Nurses are underpaid. They've been basically passed a law saying they can't get any pay raises for the next year or two. And so that's making it hard to recruit new nurses to certain places. So I think is COVID crashing the system? No, absolutely not. But these measures of firing nurses, of having forced testing, these coercive public health measures are definitely burning people out and making the healthcare system into a cold, kind of unfeeling place that does not consider ethics or putting their patients' needs ahead of COVID measures. And so that burns a lot of people out, and they're at some point they said they're done with it. And that's definitely the feeling of the colleagues that I worked with, that they're done with all these measures that are kind of interfering with their ability to provide compassionate care to patients. And so I think if it's going to crash from anything, in my experience, it's going to be from that. It's all these public health measures and the lack of morale that they're causing.
I'm actually not too upset if the system to some degree crashes, because it seems that there's been a lot of mismanagement. If you're talking about for years and years and years, a socialized system can't provide enough beds. And I think there's a whole philosophical conversation there about how you incentivize growth and all of that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. But certainly, I feel for all of those individuals who are in this system and are feeling compromised every single day. I couldn't imagine what it would be like if I had to go in and put on a mask and a face shield and walk around with gloves on, and especially if I wasn't scared. Like, it would be hard enough to do it if I was really, really scared. It would still be hard. Yeah. But if I wasn't scared and my mind could easily go flu treatment, treat seniors this way, you know, go that route for someone who's obese, there's that. I don't know if I would have lasted 2 weeks without walking off the job, as far as by my own conscience and conviction. So I guess I applaud so many of them. On the other hand, why hasn't the system collapsed? Like, is it just people's paychecks? Like, why haven't we seen in every hospital in Canada, 50% of the hospital to say, hey, look, we're out. If you're going to keep doing what you're doing, we're out. And you and I both know that the government would be forced the next day to do something differently. So
yeah,
are you hearing from people why, like, how is it possible that the medical community can keep selling this? Sorry, that the media can keep selling that the medical community has bought into this wholesale? Is it just fear? Is it just sacrifice that people have been unwilling to take, especially if they're all close to burnout? Like, why haven't people just massively said, today is a day, we're all walking off, and we'll see you all tomorrow because they're going to do something about it.
So I would say, yeah, I think the majority of the medical community actually has bought into the whole kind of COVID narrative that this is a dangerous disease that we need to protect everybody from. So I would say that is true, that the majority feel that way. And is it the majority who are in burnout? No. But it's a significant minority, enough that there's a lot of people who enjoy their job even during the pandemic, right? But all it takes is, like I said, that that small minority who's at that edge of almost about to call it quits, because everybody has their line, right? If you get overworked enough, you're gonna get burnt out and you're gonna quit. And so there's a few people who are close to that, and all it takes is a few more restrictions or a few more patients that they're just going to not be able to cope anymore. And that's not everybody, but enough. And then what happens is, like I said, when you lose one of those nurses, everybody else has to work harder. So that pushes more people towards that burnout line. I think the big issue that we have right now is everybody has their line. Not many people want to give up a well-paying job, because most jobs in healthcare are well-paying, especially during an economic downturn. So it takes quite a bit, actually. You have to be pretty burnt out to give up a job in healthcare in that sense. But what we're seeing with these mandates, whether it's forced testing against your will, which is, like I said, a violation of the Healthcare Consent Act and the Criminal Code of Canada, but especially when they're mandating these mRNA gene therapies that we know cause very serious adverse events, whether it's myocarditis, blood clots, strokes, heart attacks, all of those have been reported in the vaccine adverse event reporting system. And as I can tell you, I've seen them firsthand in people who recently got the vaccine, major strokes in previously healthy people within days after the vaccine. And you can't unsee that kind of thing. And so when they're going to force, so there's a lot of people who are aware of these side effects who might not be willing to speak out, but enough that they're not, they know for sure they're not going to take it. They're not going to risk their children going without a parent. That then becomes the line. And so that's what we're seeing with these mandates, is that there's a lot of people who aren't willing to be forced into testing against their will, testing that can have you trapped at home without an income for 14 days. Or in some cases like Australia, have you removed from your own home and put into a COVID camp. That's not far off. They're building those camps here in Canada, but they exist in Australia, and they're doing that for people who test positive for COVID. And so seeing what happening in Australia, that's kind of been the line for me. When they force testing that can remove your civil rights, it becomes dangerous to get a test. And so, so what we're seeing with these mandates with Directive 6 here in Ontario and in other provinces who have similar measures is that's the line. And that's when we're going to see large amounts of people deciding that they'd rather get fired than have their civil rights taken away or their right to bodily integrity in choosing which medical treatments they want or don't want.
So I was going to wrap up our conversation, but you just mm-hmm. opened up such an important part of it. And it is the adverse reactions to the vaccine. So, I think one of the things that I have been so dismayed by is the dismissiveness of the medical community to anybody who says, can you at least look into if that was related? Mm-hmm. So I'm looking right now at a Barry 360, which is a online publication in our area. And it says, health unit says nothing to suggest COVID vaccine had anything to do with beaten teen's death. And so in our area, there was a boy from Beaton who was 17 years old, and he passed away suddenly. And the story is that he had, in order to play hockey, there was some desire for him to be vaccinated. And the article goes on to say, you know, the individual had received a dose of the vaccination more than a month before passing away. So said Dr. Charles Gardner, medical officer of health for Simcoe Muskoka District Health Unit. By the way, Dr. Gardner is my personal physician. He's told me when I can and when I cannot worship. He's sent me these wonderful little notes and orders for the doors of my church to tell me when I can and cannot go to church. So me and Dr. Gardner, we're like this. He really cares for me as an individual because he's examined me zero times. But Dr. Gardner, so he says there's nothing in his history or medical records to suggest an adverse reaction of significance or myocarditis, despite what may be portrayed on social media. So the title is the health unit says nothing to suggest. And that, so it's like social media rumors put to rest by medical officer of health.
Now, did he have an autopsy?
Well, that would be a good question.
Yeah.
So are you seeing this dismissiveness? Now, look, if he did do an autopsy, then could you conclusively prove either way right now that quickly? Or like, how would we have a realistic observation? Actually, that's what I want to do. I don't want to inflame the situation. I want to say, look, if I have an adverse reaction, what is the difference between a doctor just looking at me and saying, no, of course it had nothing to do with that, and actually looking into if there is a connection? What would be a process that would be good?
Yeah. So when you're looking into these things, it's important to look at a few things. So sometimes you can look at in the individual. So for example, if you did an autopsy or something and you found that his heart was inflamed, and we know already that the vaccine causes heart inflammation. There you have it. Boom. You know, so unless he got myocarditis from something else, which is extremely rare, then you kind of have your answer there. Because the big thing to consider with sudden death, with myocarditis, is that sudden death is sometimes the first presentation, because when you get inflammation of the heart, you might not have any other symptoms. But what it can do is make your heart more prone to go into an abnormal rhythm. And then when it goes into that abnormal rhythm, we call it ventricular fibrillation or ventricular tachycardia, and that's what causes sudden death. So, an autopsy is often helpful. But if the autopsy is normal, it doesn't mean the vaccine didn't cause it. It could just be something you didn't see. So the main way, honestly, to figure out whether the vaccine was the cause or not is to look at more at a population level. So we're seeing record numbers now of news stories of young people basically dropping dead after the vaccine. And the key to look at is you got to look at what is the rate of this in the population before the vaccine came out, and what was it after the vaccine came out. And they have done some studies of that in the UK, where they found that the excess mortality in the teenage age group has gone up something like 25 to 50% this year, right? And so if you think of last year, there's no vaccine. This year there is. That's definitely a concern, right? So it is hard to tell on the individual level whether something is caused by the vaccine or not, which is why you have to look at the population level. And so, that's why it's very important they not just reject your adverse event offhand just because they don't think it's linked. You have to look at the population level. You have to record all of them and see, wait, are we seeing an increased number of heart attacks after people get the vaccine? And that might be the case, right? So if you saw heart attacks went up 50% and people got the vaccine, even though in your case, you got a heart attack after, you can't know, maybe your heart attack was one of the ones that would have happened anyway. But if you look in the population level and you see the increased rate, then you could be like, okay, no, we know the vaccines are causing this. So you have to accept all of them and record all of the adverse events, whether it's related, you think it's related or not. And then you have to aggregate them and look on a population level. And what I can tell you they're doing here is they're only looking on the individual level and then dismissing them. So in my local public health district, our chief medical officer rejected all five of my first adverse event reports. And that's fine if it was just one or two of them, but he rejected all of them, and which is very concerning to me. And so I actually ended up publishing his letter saying that he rejected them all. But I have major concerns about the safety system we have here in Canada, because they need to accept all of them and then determine later on, is the rate higher than the baseline rate of these adverse events in the first place? So they shouldn't be rejected, even if you don't think it's related. Unless, for example, it started before you got the vaccine. That's a different reason. You know what I mean? If you got sick on a Friday and you got the vaccine on a Sunday and then you died on a Monday, then it's kind of hard to know, right? Because
it's might have interesting. Died from a sickness. Even as you're talking there, I'm hearing a little bit both of about the humility of being so decisive. So, on one hand, a young healthy boy has a heart attack. I'm trying to verify. I'm trying to look up if any other source says that that's exactly how he died. Cause actually in that article, it doesn't say. So there's another Alliston article here that says that he immediately suffered multiple health problems and he unexpectedly passed away. And it says he died as a result of a heart attack, according to this Twitter user. Okay. So they've gone in and looked up a Twitter account, but what you're saying is, okay, so if an autopsy was done and there was myocarditis or there, number one, if I just had a normal heart attack, like something that wasn't caused by anything, am I going to present like I have myocarditis? Is that like just a fancy word for saying someone's had a severe heart attack or is having heart problems or?
So a heart attack is different from myocarditis. So in general, a heart attack or a myocardial infarction, usually what we're referring to is a blocked artery. So a blood clot or a plaque basically that blocks off an artery, and then that causes one section of the heart to die off. And so that's usually what we're referring to with a heart attack. Whereas myocarditis is kind of an infection or a basically inflammation of the whole heart, of the muscle of the heart. So it's a generalized inflammation, not just one segment where an artery got blocked. So yeah, if they're saying heart attack, it doesn't sound like myocarditis, but you could have both. But well, I'm not saying this guy had myocarditis because I don't really know.
Absolutely. And actually, the articles are both vague, and none of them are publishing anything from an autopsy. But I think what I'm trying to get to, and as I was listening to you, was what should be happening is this 17-year-old boy had a medical procedure within this amount, and. Yeah. Whether it is actually correlative or not, it needs to be recorded. Yeah. And when this happened, plus when this happened and what happened, needs to be investigated. And absolutely. You may not be able to directly say this did that until you record across the nation. And if mm-hmm. you're seeing a number of this and then that, that's yeah. when you go, okay, we got an abnormality and we have a cause. So I think this is the thing that I find difficult, because it requires a bit of humility, both to not try to call it too soon. But mm-hmm. on the other hand, there's always this get out of jail free card, it seems, where even if you were to say, look, we're seeing a spike in 15% of young, healthy men having this situation, it seems like a get-out-of-jail-free card for vaccines, because they still get to go, but you can't prove it one for one. Is that the way that it really is? Or is there, on the back of the box, it says, these are the things that, these are the health risks. And within this time frame, this person suffered this, the autopsy shows it, therefore it is able to go, yes, this is a, do you know what I'm getting at? Like, it seems like a macro level.
It's hard to prove anything definitively. So the best way to prove whether something's the cause of another thing is to have a randomized control trial, right? Where you give a random group of people the vaccine, and you give another random group of people that all have the same characteristics, not the vaccine. You give them a placebo, and then you look to see what happens afterwards. And that's what they're supposed to do with these long-term trials, right? But they're no longer recording, right? So as far as like the long-term adverse effects. So that's the best way to tell causation. The other is to basically, like I said, look at the temporality of it and look to see if there's something you can definitively link to the vaccine. But the other way as well is through temporality. So for example, when they're looking at, they did an analysis of the deaths and the VAERS system. And what they found was that like something like 80% of the deaths happened within 2 to 3 days. And then it slowly went down. So if you think here, if people got the vaccine here, all the deaths reported in the system, most of them were in the first few days, and then they sloped down. So then a few of them, less of them were at 1 week and less of them were at 2 weeks. And so that's actually, when you look at and you see that kind of a curve, that's a good indicator of causality. Because if you were just picking up random deaths that were going to happen anyway, there should be the same amounts on day one as there were on day two, as there were on day three, right? Because if it's just people, because people die, right? Of course, you're going to give the vaccine to some people and they're just going to die, and they would have died anyway. But you wouldn't see that kind of a curve. You would see flat. You'd see 500 people die on day one, 500 people die on day two, six, it might vary a little bit, but you don't get this huge curve of like, oh, they're all happening right away. And then it slowly goes out. So that's another way that you can kind of look at some indicators that indicate causality. But again, for that, you have to accept all of them. You have to be like, no, this is definitely wasn't caused by the vaccine. It's not even going to go in the system. So that is inappropriate, because then you're not going to pick up things that you're not looking for. And that's the key there.
You said something that troubled me a little bit. You said, you know, if I put five VAERS reports in, I'm okay with, but you know, two would have been normal for the guy to stop. I don't like that at all. Mm-hmm. That seems like some guy who wasn't a part of the process gets to throw out 50% of the data. Like,
yeah,
if you're the guy on the ground, you're putting the reports in, there's a responsibility to go to look at everything.
Absolutely.
I can't even imagine that we live in a country where a doctor could say, here are five cases that I'm very concerned about. And some bureaucrat in the region gets to say, yeah, but even though I wasn't there, didn't look into anything, I get to throw out 50% of the data. Yeah. Even if that guy was on my side, like even if, you know, a cure to help short men grow taller, and all of a sudden it was working, and then someone was going to throw out two out of five of those findings, that like, even if it was a positive reaction, I think it's just absolutely ridiculous to think that our reporting system would give someone the power to veto a doctor simply reporting a possible connection.
Yeah, exactly. Because like I said, even if he's right that it wasn't caused by the vaccine, it doesn't matter, because you're losing that data that's going to allow you to find those links in the data, in the aggregate data, that's actually going to give you the safety signal, right?
Yeah,
so even if that one heart attack wasn't caused by the vaccine, right, they shouldn't be able to pull it out, because you need to see whether or not there's a spike in heart attacks, right? So,
right. So even if they left it in, it would only help the data,
yeah,
to reflect that. No, like how far downstream is it that actual data is correlated?
So in Canada, we have an awful system. It's the CAFIS system. And especially here in Ontario, there's so many levels of censorship in this data that it's almost useless. Whereas in the United States, they can basically submit a report directly to the VAERS system. I think there is one step of verification, but then it gets into the system. In Canada, at least in Ontario, what we do is we fill out adverse event reports, which go to our local public health officer, and he decides whether or not it counts. And then he passes it along to Public Health Ontario. So that's the central system. And then they aggregate that and decide what counts and what doesn't. And then they report that to the Health Canada system. And again, on all those levels, the data can be modified or filtered out if there's things in there that they don't feel meet their criteria. So it's, in my opinion, it's the data going into that system is useless. It's not going to pick up any safety signals. And if you look at our record throughout the world, if you look at AstraZeneca, where they started to pick up these blood clots and things, Canada has never been on the leading edge of catching safety signals. If you look at the Moderna vaccine causing myocarditis, you see it's been Norway, Norway, Denmark, the Scandinavian countries have been the ones to pick up a lot of these safety signals and to halt the vaccine rollout in some places. Canada's safety system is appalling, in my opinion. It's opaque and has high levels of censorship in it, which I think is a big problem. So when I look at my safety data, I generally go to the US. I look at the VAERS system, although they have not been any better at actually clawing back or restricting their vaccine rollout, their data actually is pretty good. So the VAERS system is relatively transparent, and you can see the reports yourself. You can just look them up as a matter of public record.
Okay, so you've been very generous with your time, but I want to, if I could, I would just really like to process that last point on this, the VAERS system. So what you're saying is if every report just went into the system, there would be downstream, there would be analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And in that analysis, there would be, I want to say charts, I want to say graphics, all of these things that would be some type of visualization of an interpretation of the data.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And what you're saying is even if you said, okay, look, we had... Now, so to be really clear, we'd have to be careful not to say 250 million VAERS reports have been filled in without any analysis of the data, because we'd be operating in a freer, more trying to be more transparent, which would mean there'd be more reports. Now, that being said, maybe that mm-hmm. is a significant number in and of itself that we could talk about. But at yeah. some point, someone would say, yes, but of those reports, these were analyzed and they clearly were not connected in any way to the vaccine. And what it would do is it would bring, if it was truly safe and compelling, then that number, even if the bigger number of case reports was there, mm-hmm. the analysis would actually present, okay, out of all of the cases, actually it was a very low percentage. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, you have to take it all with a grain of salt in some sense, but we also have the advantage with the vaccine adverse event reporting system of it being a system that's been in place for 20 years at least. And what we can look at as well is, okay, we've been giving out millions upon millions of vaccines every year, right? Because they're given to children every year. The flu vaccine goes out every year to most people. And so you want to look as well at other years and see, okay, well, what's the average number of deaths, you know, that are reported to this system previously? So prior to 2021, I can tell you the average number of deaths is between 200 and 300 per year.
Like reported.
Reported to the vaccine adverse event reporting system.
Right? So we are not talking about analyzed and out of the 200 or 300.
Yeah.
We're just talking about in total.
Just reported.
Yeah. Just reported.
Yeah.
Okay.
And if you look as well, just to provide a little more context of the swine flu vaccine in 1971, it was brought out and it was kind of rushed out in 1 year, and it was linked to some health issues, but it was linked in particular to about 25 to 50 deaths. And after about nine or 10 states actually halted the vaccine rollout. So 9 to 10 deaths. And after about 25 deaths, it was halted completely. So pulled off the market, right? After 25 deaths. And if you want to know, and so just with that number, they pulled the vaccine off the market. And so if you look at all the vaccines in general, average about 200 to 300 deaths per year. In 2021 alone, there's over 16,000 deaths reported to the vaccine first reporting system. Like, it is off the charts. So at that level, like, there's no excuse in any way for this vaccine rollout to not be halted immediately. If you look at any previous precedent, this number is, it doesn't even matter, even if a small tiny percentage of those were even linked to the vaccine. So say it was just like 5 to 10%, right? So 10% would be 1,600. So that's like a four times the amount of normal amount of deaths that are reported to the system. That would be a huge safety signal if only 10% of them were actually linked, right? So it's definitely more than 10%. So the safety signals of these vaccines are off the charts, which is why I feel very strongly that they should be pulled off the market immediately, pending investigation. That's what we would have done for any other vaccine or any other pharmaceutical that was on the market. When they start to see people dying after they get it, we pull it off and we investigate. And often those pharmaceutical products never go back on the market, because we don't risk people's lives on novel pharmaceutical treatments. That's not what we've previously done in the healthcare community. And so if you look at those numbers, like, you don't even need a large percentage of them to be linked to the vaccine, which they clearly are if you look at the analysis of that data. But the safety signals are unprecedented, and which is why I feel so strongly that we need these off the market. They're not safe, and they absolutely should not be mandated for anybody to get.
Yeah, that's the thing that I'm sitting here processing. I'm thinking, not only does Patrick want them not mandated. He's saying we should pull them from the shelves. And and I'm thinking in my brain, we're doing the opposite. We're penalizing anybody who, like, people are losing their jobs over.
Yeah.
Well, look, I just, I think I'm going to end the podcast on a classic Mike Tyson. Don't finish the end of your sentence. My wife always says that to me. She says, you sometimes you just have a thought and you say half of it and you don't end your sentence. So I think it's classic that we do that. I don't want to take too much more of your time. Very thankful for your courage and speaking up, and hope that in the future, Patrick, you and I can have many good conversations about life and about the world, because it's been very helpful to hear your perspective today. So thank you for coming on. And everybody, would you go and give this a 5-star rating? And of course, if you know of someone who's read some of these articles about Dr. Phillips, I would encourage you to share this podcast with them so that they can get, I think, a much more balanced and what we would call long form information. We've talked for an hour here, so you can get a sense of whether or not these accusations are in any way true. And of course, I don't believe they are, but share this with your friends. Thanks for listening, everybody. Godspeed.
Thanks for tuning in to this Liberty Coalition Canada interview, a united front to restore liberty and justice in Canada. Please subscribe to our podcast and Rumble channel, as well as visit our website at www.libertycoalitioncanada.com.